Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today has written two acclaimed books, one on how manufacturers create products by planned obsolescence, the book Made to Break, and then how technologies undermine interpersonal relationships, The Big Disconnect. But the book he originally wanted to write, no publisher would touch, at least until the first vestiges of his subject began to occur. And that subject is climate-induced migration. Now, the headlines on this usually refer to a South Pacific atoll threatened by rising sea levels. But in fact, on mainland North America, indigenous Alaskan villages have already been forced to move inland due to erosion and rising storm surges. My guest states that this will continue on a much larger scale as climate change continues. In fact, he writes that migration has always been an outcome of climate change throughout human history. And controversially states that this has already been a part of the reason for the migration into the United States from Mexico and the South. And even more controversially says that in the future, Americans will migrate northwards towards Canada. Giles Slade is a Canadian former academic who's now a journalist and writer, a writer of books and print journals. His latest book is titled American Exodus, Climate Change and the Coming Flight for Survival. He says that if scientists are right in predicting the sea will rise by 1.5 meters, about 3 to 4 feet before 2100, we will see mass migrations around the globe. He joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Giles Slade, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You write several times in your book about American Exodus's beginnings, which predates your two previous books, and publishers really didn't want to touch a book that examined climate-induced migration. Now, several years later, you said that's completely changed. Why do you think that is?
Well, I guess in 2009, when I first pitched the book, there were only 30% of Americans believed in climate change. And now about 72 or 78%, depending on which poll you read, believe in climate change and believe that we have to do something in it about it. So I think over the intervening, 3 or 4 years, enough extreme weather events have happened that Americans have sort of looked up and said, what is this and what are we going to do about it?
Well, how would you define the term climate-induced migration? And is this something that scientists and demographers and your big international governmental organizations, are they starting to talk about climate-induced migration?
Yeah, there's a short form for it now. It's climigration, which is very difficult to pronounce, and I don't think it's a very good word. They talk about refugees, which technically means people fleeing across international borders. And if there's not an international border involved, they call them internally displaced people. So these different categories make it very hard to sort of document how many people are fleeing from climate change. But in 2012, the UN estimates that 32 million people were put in motion because of extreme weather events. And that's a very conservative figure because it comes from the UN.
32 million already.
32 million, yeah. And of those, I think it was 786,000 in the United States largely because of Superstorm Sandy.
Mm-hmm. And is there an official definition of what climate-induced migration is?
There are a lot of them, but technically I like to use the word climate refugees because and I like to use it simply as people who are seeking refuge from extreme weather events. I mean, that seems like a very straightforward definition. But for the United Nations, they're concerned with international boundaries, and they have very technical definitions that are very difficult to follow, that qualify people for receiving aid or not receiving aid. So they're sort of, they have two aspects to them. One is to help people and one is to limit funding.
Well, right. Why limit funding?
Because I guess nobody really wants to spend money on international migration because, they're no longer in one country and they're in another country usually as unwelcome guests.
Right. In fact, one of the first sections of your book looks at the issue of Mexican immigration into the United States. And I think most Americans would believe that that's a simple economic decision. But you write that climate change and environmental devastation has really had a major effect on the number of Mexicans that have immigrated legally and otherwise into the United States.
Yeah, these two issues, environmental collapse and economic collapse, are sort of twins. And they go together in a very consistent way across human history. So as the environment changes, the economy becomes stressed and collapses, which increases more environmental devastation. Or, as the economy collapses, the environment becomes more stressed, which increases the economic devastation. So in Mexico, after 1982, you had something that's called La Crisis. The economy collapsed after, you know, because they couldn't repay their loans for the petroleum infrastructure. People started farming, subsistence farming in northern Mexico. But at the same time, global warming was heating up the northern states of Mexico, and it became very difficult for all these people to achieve, you know, enough food to eat. So they fled to Mexico City, first of all, and then to the United States when Mexico City swelled and couldn't support all these people. And now there's 25 million Mexicans out of an entire population of 110 million who live, eat, work, and sleep in the United States. So you got a quarter of the Mexican country there.
And what's interesting is how much that return to subsistence farming devastated the local environment. And you're right that it was the fact that it was just a few degrees warmer, and this caused clear cutting and really massive salinization of the land.
Yeah, when people get desperate, things start to happen very quickly. And so with the combination of heat, as the tropics expand towards the poles, much of northern Mexico turned to desert and became very hot. And now even that little lizard that you see when you cross the border, the little mesquite lizard, you know, it's an endangered species because it's too hot for that.
Hmm. I wanted to take a step back. You were talking about public opinion earlier and how that's changed. But I think this is one of the difficulties in pinning down climate change. Public opinion can shift based on a summer's weather or a winter's weather. You know, if we have a lot of blizzards, we have extreme cold in the winter, flooding in the summer, or cool weather in the summer, all of a sudden public opinion shifts on climate change and man-made climate change. And if you have a hot summer, heat waves, droughts, hurricanes, tornadoes, early springs, late winters, it tends to really function. And, of course, year-to-year weather, it's really hard. You have a whole section on how scientists are having trouble finding the smoking gun that will correlate weather to climate change.
Yeah, it's getting easier because things are happening a lot faster. Sort of one-in-a-century events like Superstorm Sandy or Typhoon Haiyan are happening with increased frequency and intensity. North Atlantic hurricanes really didn't used to happen. Maybe there'd be one every 100 years. But as Governor Cuomo said, I think, last year, you know, now we're getting one-in-a-century storms every 3 years. And when you look at, you know, the satellite pictures of it, you can see the curve of the Earth across the northern hemisphere. And then there's just this big blob of 1,000-mile wide and 1,200-mile wide superstorm hitting the coast of the United States. And the same thing is true of Typhoon Haiyan. These things just didn't used to happen this frequently. You know, I think Typhoon Haiyan is the 12th largest storm that we know of in the Earth's history, you know. So more and more people are becoming convinced. And I guess there in Oklahoma, you know, I'm sure you've experienced the drought that's been troubling Texas since 2008. And I think a majority of Texans, irregardless of what party they belong to, I think 78% of Texans now believe completely in climate change and want their government to do something about it.
Yeah, I know you quote Gary McManus from the Oklahoma Climatological Survey. And, of course, we are coming off, prior to this past summer, two of the hottest summers on record and big droughts. But, the rains return. And I think this is the hard thing for people to get their head around. You know, I think they still believe global warming is man-made and occurring and climate change. But I think the idea that it's going to get to the point where you're going to see vast migrations of people is still hard for people to fathom because, you know, we will have crops fail, but then the rains return, the climate returns to more normal conditions, and it's just sort of like the creeping of the extreme weather events seem to be masked by the fluctuations in weather.
Yeah, and I guess, tornadoes is a really good case in point. There's a whole controversy about whether tornadoes are in fact increasing. The number of tornadoes are increasing. And, you know, people, I guess, who don't seem to want you to believe in climate change say, no, in fact, the number of reported tornadoes are increasing because there are, you know, more people reporting tornadoes. But if you don't look at the United States Geographical Survey's graph of reported tornadoes, but instead look at University of Lincoln's graph of actual tornadoes, you'll see an increase since the 1950s, maximum about 800 tornadoes per year in the 1950s, to about 1,600 in the first decade of the 21st century. So there's more heat in the world's meteorological system, and this creates regional climate changes, and that means that the highs are hotter and that the colds are colder. And so you get extremes at both ends. But meanwhile, winter's shrinking. Spring now comes 2-3 weeks earlier. And also songbirds have moved 300 to 400 miles north for their winter home. So the plant and animal life is responding to these changes and gradually creeping towards the 49th parallel, just as the tropics are. And now, you know, off the coast of Labrador here in Canada, we have lobsters where there it was just too bloody cold for lobsters before. And in Tuktoyaktuk on the coast of the Arctic Ocean, there are robins. And in the it's kind of charming. I mean, in the local papers have articles sort of explaining what these red birds are, you know. They don't belong here. They're not white, you know.
Right. Well, in the book, you kind of describe the conundrum of California as this sort of microcosm of what's going to happen in the United States, because California is this huge state. It has coastal issues. It has inland agricultural that depends on imported water for the most part. You have cities that depend on mountain water and snowpack. And really, it's a microcosm of a lot of the issues confronting the rest of the country. Very prone to drought, dependent on a heavy snowpack and winter rains for this dry season in the summer. And, you know, again, a lot of times it gets couched as economic decisions in people moving out of California. But you say there are climate elements as well.
Yeah, and once again, you know, these two things are going hand in hand: the economic devastation and the environmental devastation, and they sort of feed off each other. And so, you know, in Los Angeles, where I lived, went to graduate school for 15 years, water is a really serious issue, and the snowpack has sort of disappeared in the hills. You can't go skiing anymore in the hills around L.A. And in San Diego, it's even worse. And they planned, I think, to start a desalination plant in, I think it was Huntington Beach, but it may be Pismo or someplace like that, and then decided that it was just too expensive. The power required to extract, drinkable water from seawater made it really economically infeasible. So if they can't get water from the California, from the Colorado, if they can't get water from the snowpack, where are they going to get water from? They've been taking it from the Central Valley in the north, which creates a real issue with, people who make their living from agriculture.
Well, and for consumers around the country, because California agriculture goes everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I mean, you know, we get California strawberries here. We get green grapes in the middle of winter. You know, we get California wine, you know, and if all that shuts down, it's not just California that's in deep trouble, but it's, a lot of people in the United States and elsewhere.
Well, one of the things you write about is how ocean currents affect our weather from time to time, and how climate change is likely to affect those currents. And I'm talking about El Nino and La Nina. And it's kind of interesting that you write that despite El Nino being the warm water current and La Nina being the cold water current, climate change pushes more cold water along the coast, which that seems sort of counterintuitive. And, of course, that also triggers lots of drier weather in the southwest, the southeast, and across the southern plains.
Yeah, I guess that's it. The cold water doesn't evaporate as well as warm water, so the winds that pass over, southern California and move in, across the mountains and into the Midwest and Southwest are much drier. And so there's a lot less water in the system at the same time that, your increased populations from, I guess, retirement immigrants over the past 20 years, places like Las Vegas and Dallas-Fort Worth have just, expanded radically. And also the drawing down of the local aquifers, really reduces the water. So there's a combination of factors that are making it, less and less pleasant to live. And these kinds of things have happened before, although, I guess they happened during the Dust Bowl, but they happened in the deep past, to the Anasazi, who just abandoned the Four Corners because of this.
My guest today is Giles Slade, author of The Big Disconnect and Made to Break. His latest book is titled American Exodus, Climate Change and the Coming Flight for Survival, which he brings up the idea of climate-induced migration and, in fact, asserts that it has been happening from more temperate areas in Central America and Mexico to the United States, and that as climate change continues, that migration will move ever northward, and that means to his home country of Canada. and you're right, there's a whole section on Canada which says Canada's not out of the woods with climate change because, one, you have ice packs that are in the far north that all of a sudden go away, and you have navigable travel. You also have large amounts of permafrost and boreal forests, which are seriously at risk. And just the melting of the permafrost actually exacerbates the CO2 levels in the air because it's holding tons and tons of CO2.
Yeah, we're affected in, you know, just as many ways as you are. I guess one of the most telling things to me is, you know, what's happening in Alaska. There's all the sea ice that, I guess, protected the coast of Alaska has melted away. And so now when the storm surges come in the wintertime, they just erode the coast, take huge chunks out of the coast. And I think 9 Alaskan communities have, portions of their buildings and main streets have disappeared. So the, you know, the United States Army Corps of Engineers is moving these communities, you know, 100 miles back from the coast, moving a lot of people. These are climate refugees. And although they're not crossing an international boundary, they're just moving. And, you know, the same thing is happening in Canada. We have the longest coastline of any country in the world. It's broken by Alaska, but nonetheless, we have the most coast. And we're, you know, subject to all these sea level rise changes. And there's warming, which takes place at, I guess, a more accelerated rate in the Arctic.
Yeah, you write of, places along the Arctic Circle where the summertime average temperature has been like 55, 56 degrees Fahrenheit. All of a sudden, they're seeing pretty common readings of 80 degrees, 85 degrees in the summer.
Yeah, and in places like Baffin Island, I don't know if your readers will know where this is, but it's a long, skinny island right next to Greenland. I guess one of the biggest islands in the Canadian North. There have been heat waves, and the heat waves have melted the permafrost and washed away portions of villages. So they're experiencing some really disastrous effects, and we need to start mitigating these.
Well, how are most countries dealing with a changing climate? You know, you hear in Southeastern Asia, you know, island nations are really they're running out of real estate in some cases, but they're trying to mitigate the effects of a very slow rising sea level. Which you have to say, you know, you're doing planning 10 and 20 years ahead, 30, 50 years ahead. This is not something governments are not good at all.
No, not at all. Unless you have a totalitarian government like Russia, and Russia is doing a really good job of planning for new communities in the north when people move there. I think they're about the only country, you know. But and it's not widely publicized. But you know, I mean, if you've got a central committee who are just looking at a bunch of paper, they don't have to pass it through the Senate or cope with the Tea Party. Then there's not much of a problem. So maybe I don't know. I don't think. You know, I'm a Democrat from way back. I think, I don't think totalitarianism is the way to go, but I think they may better survive this crisis than we do, you know.
Let's talk about some of the takeaways from the book. One, you say, sure. Climate change is man-made, and it seems to be occurring faster than predicted. The International Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, what are the latest thoughts on the rate of climate change?
Well, they say that, you know, the sea level will rise 1.5 meters before the end of the century. The International Panel on Climate Change, you know, they're meticulous scientists, but they're funded by governments, and governments don't really want to, are not completely friendly to the idea of global warming and to, you know, ending our dependence on fossil fuels, particularly here in Canada. We used to be environmental champions, but now, you know, we have this very conservative government that's basically, you know, a servant to the oil companies. They have to be very cautious. But even they have said it's 95% certain that global warming is happening and that men have created that mankind has created it. That it's, you know, the Anthropocene that it's mankind created climate change. If you were playing a game of poker and you waited for 95% certainty, you know, of course, you wouldn't do very well, and this is what I'm saying. I mean, the best case, the most intelligent choice, the most intelligent understanding of this has been in front of us for 20 or 30 years. People are resisting it for all kinds of reasons, maybe vested self-interest, but the time to act has really passed. And all I'm saying in the book is, I'm not even recommending this. You know, I'm just saying that this is actually what's going to happen. This is our most common response to climate change. And people are starting to look at the exits. We've got a lot more American immigration than we have had at any time since the Vietnam War, and there are now a million Americans in Canada, and Canada only has 35 million people. You know, a huge country, second largest country in the world, but only 35 million people. You have 350 million. During the Dust Bowl, 2.5 million people left the Great Plains for California. So if we get that many, you know, over the next 10, 20 years, it will radically change and also challenge our infrastructure. We need to start planning for this now. And the other thing is that although this is not, you know, just running away from it is not a good strategy, we need 20 or 30 years to begin reversing the effects of, you know, our carbon-rich atmosphere. And so this may, in fact, be, you know, a way to gain that time.
You know, I think I saw some data recently which suggested that the last couple of years, Americans have actually reduced the carbon load going into the atmosphere, but it's been all that those gains have been negated by the rest of the world and a lot of the
including Canada. You know, Canada, guilty. You know, we have these carbon rich producing tar sands project in Alberta that's just pushing our carbon levels higher and higher. And China also. China's industrialization is really damaging to the atmosphere. And I think now the atmosphere is at 400 parts per million, up from 380. We have to stop and begin to look for alternative sources and try and survive this in the best way.
Now, getting back to the takeaways, you know, we talked about the main takeaways, but then out of that, you say that, you know, migration has always been a response to climate change, whether it's been ice ages or drought, like the Anasazi's experience in the 1400s.
Yeah.
Humans have always done this, and we shouldn't expect things to change. Human nature doesn't change that quick.
And it's something that you can do as an individual, you know, without anybody's help, you know, just on your own initiative. So, you know, suddenly you just pull up and leave. Or you pull up and leave in a group. I think people are already doing this. You know, there's a larger group of Americans, as I said, in Canada than there has been at any time in the past, and I think this will continue and eventually. But these people, of course, are just migrants; they're not refugees. You know, nothing has happened. But after the second or third superstorm Sandy, or the severe continuation of the drought in the Southwest, or the riverine flooding that's just increasing through the Midwest. You know, after these disasters happen again and again and again, and you can't get insurance for, for your business anymore because you live by the ocean or because, you know, there's no water to feed your cattle or grow your crops, then people are going to start thinking, I've got to move, I'm going to do this for my children, my grandchildren.
Is there places in the world where we're already seeing large-scale evidence of human migration, or is this still to come?
Yeah, in 2012, there were 3.1 million people displaced in the Philippines. There were 9 million people displaced in India. 32 million people around the globe, and only 786,000 of those in the United States. So, a whole lot of places, usually on the sea, but then also, drought conditions, like in places like Darfur, cause people to move. So, yes, it's already happening.
Can I make a distinction between dislocation and actual migration, though? Because most of the people displaced by Superstorm Sandy have returned to that region. Most, over half or more, have returned to New Orleans after Katrina. Probably a lot of those folks in the Philippines will return.
Yeah. I think 500,000 people left New Orleans for Katrina, and the last figure I saw said that 200,000 had come back. But if this happens again, let's see. Superstorm Sandy is $80 billion worth of damage to infrastructure alone, not to, individuals or end of business.
Yeah.
So $80 billion in repairs. If that happens a second time, while the economy is troubled, or a third time while the economy is troubled, of course, insurers are going to start withdrawing the ability to have insurance for businesses and residences in that region. So people are going to be less protected, and also it's going to become much less economically feasible to rebuild. It will be, much more reasonable to relocate like they did in Galveston a long time ago, after a huge storm surge.
Well, certainly you're not advocating all Americans move to Canada. I know that. But what is the takeaway of the book? I mean, are you basically warning Canadians that the Americans are eventually going to be coming, or what exactly?
I'm saying this. I'm saying a couple of things, okay? So I'm not advocating this. I'm saying that it actually is going to happen, okay? And I'm also saying that there doesn't seem to be any political will to do anything on a global basis to reduce the carbon in the atmosphere, make the Earth a little more hospitable. So we're going to have to act individually. And when you act individually, you're going to look for a place where, you know, you'll be able to live for 20 or 30 years, you know, while the world mobilizes and tries to reduce, you know, its carbon emissions and the greenhouse gas effect. And so, you know, check out the best place possible. There are places on the continents. And this is, you know, this is troubling for everyone in from Central America north, you know. So there's a drought corridor that's much more extreme in places like Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua. These people are coming to the United States exclusively because of climate change. And it's like the toothpaste is being squeezed through the North American tube, and now it's reached, you know, it's reached the Midwest, it's reached the major cities of the United States. But climate change is going to keep happening, and it's going to squeeze the toothpaste even further north. Okay, and you either want to jump ahead of this movement, or you want to make sure that you know where you're going when you do jump.
Hmm. Will the increased size of the tropics, or is there any sense that we'll have an increased size of the tropics because of?
Yeah, I think this is exactly what's happening. I think the tropics are expanding towards the poles, and they've already sort of dehydrated northern Mexico, and now they're moving through Texas, especially, which is like the most southerly state. And you know, and the rest of the Southwest. So that massive drought that's been happening since 2008, which reduced a bit last year, I think, but that's been attributed to global warming and to the tropics expanding towards the poles. And they do this now in a probabilistic way. So it's like you can't say for sure because you haven't caught, you know, the batter with a urine test, but. Since his, you know, statistics suddenly jumped 20%, it seems like a really good bet that he's on steroids. you see what I'm saying?
That's an interesting analogy.
Yeah, I'm thinking of Lance Armstrong. You know, there was all that stuff about, oh, he has a, you know, he has a special mutation. He's got more red blood platelets, and he can deliver more oxygen to his muscles. But really, when it gets right down to it, you know, he's blood doping.
Yeah, it's transfusions is what it is.
Yeah, transfusions. And you know, they worked for Lance very well until he got caught out, you know. But we're now at the point where we have to be a bit more realistic, a bit more practical than the IPCC. You know, we're not going to get 100% certainty. You know, we need to plan for the worst-case scenario. I would love to be wrong, you know, but we can't afford to bet that I'm going to be wrong.
Well, it's a provocative book, American Exodus. Giles Slade, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Canadian writer Giles Slade speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His previous books include Made to Break and The Big Disconnect. His latest book is titled American Exodus, Climate Change and the Coming Flight for Survival. It's published by New Society Publishers. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.